Go ahead, Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael Gross. I'm appearing on behalf of Lance Shockley. This is an appeal from a conviction of capital murder and a death sentence. A number of issues are raised in the appellant's brief, and my intention today, left to my own devices, will be to address two of the evidentiary issues that have constitutional implications, and also to address two instructional issues and two other procedural issues, if I get that far, all with constitutional foundations. The first evidentiary issue has to do with the commenting by a state patrol officer on Mr. Shockley's purported propensity for violence and his character. It was a very clearly premeditated reference before the jury to the subject, to the essential question, the answer that the state would suggest to what must have been one of the central questions in the case for jurors, which is Mr. Shockley had no history of conviction for violent offenses. The murder committed in this case, whoever committed it, was a slaughter. It was a brutal murder. And there had to be a disconnect for the jury. If they're presented, they have to be asking what kind of a person can do this. The legitimate evidence in this case told the jury zero about Mr. Shockley's past history, zero about any propensity for violence. Prior to trial, at a pretrial motion hearing, the same colloquy took place between the prosecuting attorney and Trooper Heath. Prosecuting attorney, Trooper Heath and another officer had gone to Mr. Shockley's home to question him after Sergeant Graham was murdered. And when they went that evening, the woods around the house were filled with a SWAT team. At the motion hearing, the prosecuting attorney asked Trooper Heath, did you go alone? And he said, no, we were accompanied by police department, by a SWAT team. And the prosecutor said, why? And Trooper Heath said, because our superior officers, being familiar with Mr. Shockley's history of violence, I thought that was necessary. The prosecuting attorney knew exactly what answer he was going to get when he asked the same question at trial, and Trooper Heath knew exactly what answer to give, and that's exactly what happened. There had been a change of defense counsel between the time of the pretrial hearing and the time of trial, so this was not something that Mr. Shockley's trial attorney had been through. And what happened was, before you know it, Trooper Heath has told the jury this man had a history of being violent toward police that was so substantial that you couldn't go to his house to talk to him without a team of SWAT SWAT officers.
Opposing counsel says this was okay because the defense had an approach that was trying to say, why were they treating Mr. Shockley differently, and they didn't do this when they went to talk to other witnesses and so forth. So it was appropriate to bring in why they needed to have other people.
The subject of police officers as backup having been brought to the house was brought up in opening statement by the prosecuting attorney. It wasn't brought up by defense counsel. The subject of a sniper shot having been fired from the woods during the time of Mr. Shockley's interview was brought up by the prosecuting attorney, not by defense counsel. Defense counsel, in the course of cross-examining prosecution witnesses, made reference to what the prosecuting attorney had introduced into evidence. None of that had anything to do with Mr. Shockley's purported propensity for violence. This court doesn't know anything about an actual basis for believing that Mr. Shockley had any kind of violent propensities at all.
But your opponent says that this type of language was not a clear reference to any past crime, and it, therefore it was not an abuse of discretion.
What it addressed was the issue of propensity. Under the Missouri Constitution, the defendant has the right to be tried only for the crime for which he is indicted. And under the Missouri Constitution and the United States Constitution, he's entitled to due process, to a fair trial. His character was not at issue. What was at issue was, did he do this? Did he commit this remarkably unspeakable murder? And the man who sat before the jury had no legitimate evidentiary history of violence toward anybody, much less police officers. So what the statement was relevant to it, what it tended to tell, what it did tell the jury, there was no tendency about it. It told the jury from the mouth of a trooper that this individual had a history of being violent toward police officers. That tends to tell the jury, yes, indeed, this guy could have committed this crime. There's no legitimate evidence to support that. A key question in this case had to be, could Lance Shockley who could do this? And Trooper Heath told the jury, this man could do this because he has a history of violence toward police. There's no evidentiary basis for it. I do take issue with the Attorney General about whether it was pertinent to an issue in the case, and more particularly whether it was likely to be or was prejudicial in the case. It told the jury the answer to one of the great riddles in the case, and it's a bogus answer.
Counsel, the state argues that your objection to trial was character, but your argument on appeal now is propensity. Do you acknowledge the distinction, and do you think that this is something that's preserved or only for plain error review?
Well, I'd like to respond in two ways. First response would be, if it wasn't preserved, it should be reviewed as plain error, because the unfairness, the wrong that I've just described, would certainly amount to fundamental unfairness, a miscarriage of justice, if the state can cheat into the jury's consciousness this kind of bogus information about the character of a defendant in a case where the capacity for this kind of violence is a possibility. Now, to address more particularly whether it was waived or not, it wasn't. There isn't any basis for doubting that what Mr. Kessler was saying to Judge Evans was, this is the last witness in the case, in the prosecution's case. The jury has had no evidence whatsoever up till now of anything about Mr. Shockley's character or his, he didn't say propensity, but what we're talking about is his predisposition for violence. There's no disconnect between the concept of the defendant's character and the propensity for violence in the context of this case. The only character aspect that Trooper Heath was talking about, and that the prosecuting attorney was trying to get him to talk about, knew he would talk about, was the propensity, the character trait of being violent toward police. That also was the propensity. So I think that it cannot have been lost on Judge Evans, on the trial judge, that what Mr. Kessler was objecting to was telling the jury about this purported aspect of Mr. Shockley's character and propensity.
Whatever the objection that was made, what was the trial court's response to the objection?
Trial court instructed the jury to disregard the comment.
And in doing that, isn't there a wealth of case law that says that we give discretion to the trial court and the trial court's in the best position? Would we have to overrule, would we be ruling contrary to all that case law to grant the relief you're asking for?
Well, it's two questions, and the answers would be yes and no. Yes, there certainly are many cases that say that an instruction, a curative instruction, the jury can be expected to follow the curative instruction, and in the context of a particular case, of most cases, the curative instruction is enough to unring the bell. But there also are cases, including cases cited in the appellant's brief and reply brief. The Benson case comes to mind from almost 75 years ago from this court, that say that the bell can't always be unrung. If Mr. McPherson were to tell the court that he needs protection today because Mr. Gross has a propensity, has a tendency to beat up on prosecuting attorneys right after a case. The court would know well enough to discount that, but the picture would be hard to take out of your mind. We're talking about a jury that has a key question on its mind. Could this guy have committed this unspeakable crime? And they were told by a trooper at the conclusion of the prosecution's case, yes, indeed, take my word for it. We know. We had to take a SWAT team with us to interview him at his home.
Was there any kind of motion in limine filed or regarding prior crimes or prior interaction with police?
I don't recall a motion in limine. I think a relevant fact there is that there's the change of counsel. This is not something that the trial attorney. I believe that the entire transcript, including the transcript of that hearing, became available a year after trial was over. So I don't think there's any basis for believing that Mr. Kessler could have known that this issue was going to come up. But my point would be it did. And there isn't any question, any reasonable basis for wondering whether it was intentional or not. It's exactly the same question and exactly the same answer that was given between the same prosecuting attorney and the same trooper months before trial. I would move on, if there aren't any further questions about that issue, to the comment that was made by the other prosecuting attorney during the course of trial about Mr. Shockley's failure to testify. The prosecution presented witnesses who testified that Mr. Shockley's, that an automobile resembling the automobile owned by Mr. Shockley's grandmother was parked near Sergeant Graham's home, through the woods from Sergeant Graham's home, at approximately or maybe exactly the time that Sergeant Graham was murdered. And there was evidence that Mr. Shockley had borrowed his grandmother's automobile that afternoon. The critical witness for identifying the automobile was testifying, and she was asked rhetorically, I think we can say, do you know of any reason why Mr. Shockley's grandmother's car would have been parked at that edge of that woods near Sergeant Graham's house at the time Sergeant Graham was being murdered? And of course the witness said, who was a stranger to all of the personnel in the case, said, no, I don't. At which point one of the prosecuting attorneys said, someone does. And the state has suggested that that might have been a comment on, that might have been a reference to Mr. Shockley's grandmother, that she could explain why her car was parked there. That's not a reasonable suggestion, because she had already testified as a state witness and had been questioned at length by the state. She had loaned her car to Mr. Shockley at noon, and he brought the car home around 4:15. The shooting happened around 4:15.
Was there a timely objection to that comment?
I don't think there was time for an objection. My recollection is that the trial court, on its own, instructed the prosecutor to refrain from making comments, and I believe instructed the jury to disregard the comment. However, what the comment did was that it brought to the jury's attention the fact that Mr. Shockley hadn't testified, and in fact, he wasn't going to testify. It also insinuated knowledge about another essential fact or riddle in the case, the evidence that this was Mr. Shockley's grandmother's automobile parked at the edge of the woods was something less than rock-solid evidence. This was a red Trans Am, several years old. That was one of the most popular cars manufactured at the time and one of the most popular colors for that automobile. Now, it may have been the single most popular description of an automobile in Carter County at the time. So a red Trans Am being in the neighborhood tells you something, but it only tells you so much. What was unique about this red Trans Am was that there was a yellow bumper sticker, a yellow sticker on the trunk of the car. The witness who was testifying, who was the key government state witness about the presence of the automobile and the sticker, testified twice. The first two times she was asked, once by the prosecuting attorney, and then she was asked inexplicably in cross-examination again to describe how she saw the sticker. She and her husband had turned down the gravel road where the car was parked. They ran alongside the woods to go look at a house further down the street that they were thinking of renting. They turned in, and she testified that as we turned in, this automobile was parked on the wrong side of the street facing us. And I noticed the car, and I noticed, I don't know why, but this yellow sticker sticks out. I noticed the yellow sticker. It really stood out. In her deposition, she had testified that she didn't look back at the car after she went past it. She's saying that she saw a yellow sticker on the back of that was affixed to the back side of the trunk as she approached the car. It's not physically possible. She said the same thing again at the beginning of her cross-examination. Now, the fact is that defense counsel, for some reason, couldn't contain herself and decided to wrap up the cross-examination by asking the question a third time, at which point the witness equivocated and said, maybe I saw it. It was looking back at the back of the car. But the evidence was not rock-solid evidence that this is whose car this is. So when the prosecuting attorney says somebody knows, he's insinuating knowledge on the part of the state.
This was not contained in the defendant's motion for a new trial, so are we reviewing this under the plain error standard?
This isn't a preserved issue, and it's raised as plain error. And the reason that it warrants plain error review and a finding of plain error is because without the evidence of the car being there, there is no evidence tying Mr. Shockley to the shooting. There is the fact that Sergeant Graham was investigating a potential manslaughter claim against Mr. Shockley, but Sergeant Graham was investigating a lot of cases. The fact that he's investigating a crime that Mr. Shockley was suspected of being involved in is not evidence that comes close to establishing that Mr. Shockley shot him or shot him in the way that he was shot. You have to have the automobile, and it has to be Mr. Shockley's grandmother's automobile. And the prosecuting attorney was tying up the idea of it being Mr. Shockley's automobile and Mr. Shockley being the person who could explain it. He's telling the jury that you're not going to hear that it was Mr. Shockley's grandmother's car because Mr. Shockley's not going to testify. And he's also insinuating his knowledge that if Mr. Shockley did testify and was truthful, that's what he would say. And the reason that this should be reviewed as plain error is that that commenting on the defendant's election not to testify is a transgression of one of the most fundamental rights that we have in American courts. The U.S. Supreme Court has called it one of the hallmarks of our maturity as a civilized society, that you can't make somebody testify. And if you can't make them testify, you can't comment on the fact that they didn't testify. You can't highlight for the jury the fact that they didn't testify, and you sure can't suggest to the jury that the only reason they're not going to find out the truth is because the defendant's not testifying. That penalizes the defendant for exercising a fundamental right. And if that doesn't warrant plain error review, if the court finds that that is what happened, I don't know what would. I've talked a lot about evidentiary issues and not gotten to the interesting instructional or burden of proof issues in the case. The first instructional issue that I would address would be instruction 14. One of the elements under section 565.030.4 for being eligible for the sentence of death is the relative weight of aggravating and mitigating factors. The jury has to go through a three-step fact-finding process. The jury has to first find whether one or more statutory aggravating factors are present in the case. If so, the jury moves on to the second step, which is finding whether there is, considering all the evidence of mitigating factors from any place that it might have come in the case. And then the third step is weighing the aggravating and the mitigating factors. And a defendant in a capital case in Missouri is not eligible for death, for the punishment of death, unless the jury finds the relative weight of the aggravating factors is at least the weight that the jury assigns to the mitigating factors. This court has made it clear more than once case names are escaping me. The court has made it clear in the McLaughlin case and in the Whitmer case that third step, that weighing process, is a fact-finding process. The jury is finding a fact.
Whitfield.
Thank you. The determination of the relative weight is just another fact-finding step, and without that relative weight being found in favor of the state, that the weight is at least in equipoise between the two, the defendant's not eligible for a death sentence. The U.S. Supreme Court has made clear, and this court has of course followed its determination in the Apprendi case and again in the Ring case, that a defendant can't be convicted of a crime carrying a greater penalty. If there's a fact that has to be proved and found in order for a defendant to be eligible for an enhanced penalty, such as death rather than life in prison, that fact is an element of the crime. It's either an element or it's the functional equivalent of an element. That's what they said in Ring. And that fact has to be proven to a jury's satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt. So that relative weight, the state has to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, or the defendant cannot be sentenced to death. And the Missouri statute presumably recognizes that. It doesn't explicitly say so. This court has found that the statute is constitutional. I don't have that's not my chosen quarrel with what happened in this case. The legislature knew the law when it passed the statute. It knew the law when it kept the statute in effect, and it presumably knows that there's no question under Apprendi and under Ring that if that's a fact-finding process, which this court has said it is, the state has to prove the fact beyond a reasonable doubt to the satisfaction of a jury. Well, the jury was not told in Instruction 14, juries are routinely not told in Missouri, that the burden is on the state to establish the relative weight of the aggravating and mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. And without such instruction, the jury has a roving commission to decide for itself what the weighing process is and who has the burden. I wondered what I would do if Judge Baker sneezed.
And you have more time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Proceed.
I'll start with the point that Mr. Gross first began with, which was the reference to the defendant's violent history as a means of explaining why his house was surrounded by highway patrol officers. Now, it's true that in its opening statement, the prosecutor did mention that the jury would hear evidence about this shot being accidentally fired while the police were out at the defendant's house. Although the prosecutor in so stating really played down the reasoning as to why the police were there, certainly no mention or implication of violent history. Defense counsel also addressed that argument in opening statement, which really began the defense theme of trying to question whether or not the police had prejudged the defendant's guilt and whether they were out to get him and to prove he was guilty at all costs. Now, on at least four occasions during his cross-examination of witnesses before this Sergeant Heath testified, and I cited a couple of them in my brief, but in reviewing the transcript once again in preparation for the argument, I found a couple of more brief references to it, and those are at pages 1142 and 1339 of the transcript. Defense counsel asked on cross-examination state's witnesses whether it was true that the defendant was the only suspect in this crime that had his house surrounded by 20 police officers, thereby raising a negative inference that, again, the police had prejudged the defendant's guilt and that their motives in investigating the defendant were not altogether proper. Now, the state's entitled to rebut negative inferences that are created by the defense, and the reason for asking the...
Defense asked those questions on cross or on direct
before Sergeant Heath testified. He was, as Mr. Gross said, the last state's witness. So this came in towards the end of the case. That is true. And again, the reason for asking that is you've heard all this about the police have the defendant's house surrounded by all these officers. Why were there so many officers there? And the answer given was a very brief and nonspecific one, the defendant's violent history. And that's all the further it went. Now, of course, there was an objection made, but there's certainly no...
What relevance is there to that question except to elicit the defendant's alleged prior violent history?
It's to give the jury some understanding of the circumstances as to why do you need all these police officers. And I agree, if the state had gone into tried to go into some great detail about the defendant's prior history, that would have been improper. But just to say that we've got some legitimate concerns because of this, I don't think goes beyond that and does not go beyond what's reasonably necessary to rebut this inference that the defense tried to raise. Again, it's a very nonspecific reference. Doesn't suggest the defendant's done anything that even comes close to approaching murder. So I disagree with Mr. Gross's argument that somehow the fact that maybe there's some history of violence necessarily shows he has to be a murderer. We could be talking about some simple assaults, things of a far lesser scheme than that. But again, an objection was made right away. It was sustained, and the jury was given a corrective instruction. And it does fall within the purview of the court to determine whether or not the drastic remedy of a mistrial is the only necessary step to correct. And given the vagueness of the reference, the fact that the objection was made very quickly, I think it certainly can be said that the court did not abuse its discretion in determining that a mistrial was not necessary, but that the corrective actions that it took were sufficient to deal with the issue. On the other comment that Mr. Gross brings up on the presence of the defendant's grandmother's car near the scene of the shooting, a reference to a defendant's right or invocation of their right not to testify has to necessarily imply that only the defendant can explain whatever the matter under review is. Now, there's no question that a car was there. And while Mr. Gross says the link to the car being that of the defendant's grandmother is weak, in fact, the couple that drove by and saw it both testified they were 100% sure after seeing the car later on, that's the same car. And we all know the situation where you can see cars, even though they might be a popular make and model, you see a car in there, just something about the way it looks that you can recognize that's a car I know. I've got a gray Honda Accord, which is a very common car. I see it all the time, but I don't have any trouble finding it in a parking lot. I know it's my car as opposed to someone else's. So the evidence was pretty clear. And the fact is, regardless of who put it out there, somebody did. And therefore, somebody knew how it got there. It didn't just get there by itself. So this is not a direct reference, certainly, to the defendant not testifying. For one thing, there's no reference made to defendant to testify, the things we traditionally associate with a direct reference. And it's really not even an indirect reference because it's not something that only the defendant could testify to. We talked a little bit in the brief about the grandmother. Certainly we're not suggesting she drove it out there, but perhaps she knew more than she was letting on about how it got there. And while there's no evidence necessarily that the defendant had an accomplice with him when he went out there, the evidence doesn't exclude that possibility either. So there are many possibilities as to who could explain how the car got out there. But most importantly, whether you consider it a reference or not, whether you consider it a direct reference or not, no objection was made. And the jury also was given the no adverse inference instruction when the defendant subsequently decided not to testify in this case. And there's a wealth of case law which we've cited, which says that in the absence of a contemporaneous objection and with the giving of that no adverse inference instruction, that even a direct reference to testify is not going to constitute plain error. And certainly when you look at the totality of the evidence in this trial, where this statement came in, say that, that these two little words that were just made in passing, were not repeated, were not emphasized, somehow poisoned the well to the fact that we can't say the defendant got a fair trial and the jury's unreliable, the record just doesn't support that kind of an argument.
Appellant's counsel suggested that the court had given a limiting instruction sua sponte right then.
Wasn't suggested, and the court generally is not, you know, going to be convicted of error for not sua sponte taking such action, especially because in a case like this, you know, in the post-conviction realm, we often say the failure to object isn't necessarily going to be ineffective as a counsel because counsel might have strategic reasons for not objecting. Counsel could very well have had strategic reasons for not wanting a limiting instruction at that point because it could only just draw more attention to the comment, and counsel may very well have thought, let that one go. You know, it's not worth the making a big fuss about and drawing more attention to it. So I think that the court would have perhaps invited error by giving an instruction sua sponte, rather than just letting counsel be responsible. And certainly counsel was not shy about making objections when they needed to be made. As far as the instruction number 14, I'd go back to the Supreme Court's decision in Marsh v. Kansas and the previous holding in Walton v. Arizona, which it affirmed, which is that the Constitution does not prohibit the states from placing the burden on a defendant to prove that mitigating circumstances outweigh aggravating circumstances, which is the way that our statute is written. Our instructions comply with that statute. The instructions have been found constitutional in the past, and there's no reason to deviate from those holdings in this case. If the court has questions on those or any other issues, I'd be glad to address them. But if not, we'd ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed.
Thank you very much, especially for your judicious use of your time. Mr. Gross.
The trial court didn't have any trouble recognizing the potential harm in Sergeant Heath's reference to Mr. Shockley's purported violent background. The court had a clear and unequivocal response. It just wasn't enough. In this case, that issue, that question of what is Mr. Shockley's character and what are his propensities, and trying to match that up with the crime that he was charged with, was too important. That was a bell that was not going to get unrung from the appellant's point of view. The same thing was true about the comment that was made by the assistant prosecuting attorney about somebody knowing why this automobile was parked next to the woods. The trial court didn't wait for an objection. It jumped on that all by itself. And the notion that because it's two words might guide this court in figuring out what the weight of that comment might have been and what the significance of it would have been and how profound the constitutional violation was, is that's not going to withstand scrutiny. There are plenty of two-word phrases or one-word, single words, that could be spoken during the course of a trial that would amount to an improper comment on a defendant's decision not to testify or on some other aspect of a defendant's rights. The Kansas versus Marsh invocation and the Walton invocation, I think I'll wrap up by reacting to those the citation of those cases. In Kansas versus Marsh, the U.S. Supreme Court was looking at Kansas's statute, which is similar in significant ways to Missouri statute, but also dissimilar in a significant way. That can't, that statute explicitly says that the prosecution bears, the state bears the burden of proving the relative weight of aggravating and mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt to the satisfaction of the jury. It's implicit in the Missouri statute, but there wasn't any reason for the U.S. Supreme Court to address the issue that's present in this case, which is did the instruction properly guide the jury about the burden of proof? The statute itself told the jury what the burden of that the state bore the burden of proof. Walton was overruled in its most fundamental regards by Ring, and in the regard that matters in this case, it was overruled. Walton had said that the existence of aggravating factors was a sentencing concept and not an element of the crime. After Apprendi, that wasn't a sustainable point of view. Apprendi said, if there's a fact that has to be found in order for an enhanced punishment to be given, in Apprendi it was a hate crime. In order for an assault to be a hate crime assault, the facts constituting hate had to be found. And Apprendi said that those facts become an element of the crime, of the enhanced crime of assault motivated by hate. And those facts, that element has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. In Ring, the Supreme Court said the existence of aggravating factors has to be proved. Without aggravating factors, you cannot impose a death sentence. You can't enhance the punishment for first-degree murder by making it by making the punishment death. And therefore, the existence of aggravating factors, if you don't want to call them an element, they're the functional equivalent of an element. In this case, under Missouri statute, you can't, a defendant is not eligible for death unless the relative weight of the, unless the jury finds the relative weight of the mitigating and aggravating factors to be such that the aggravating factors weigh at least as much as the mitigating factors. You can't sentence somebody to death unless that finding is made, and this court has said that's a factual finding. It's an element of the offense. And therefore, the jury has to be told that element has to be, they have to find that element to have been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Nothing in Kansas versus Marsh says the contrary. And in fact, Ring says exactly what I'm saying. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under submission.